Psalm 19, beginning at verse 1 and ending at verse 14, just to give you, that's not the first reading. Psalm 19, you've just given everyone a preview. Is it not there? Well, I'll just read it from here. I'll click one of them then, unless I've just, I might have cocked up. I probably have. No, it's all right. Psalm 19, verses 1 to 14, to give you some hope, is all of the psalm. Okay? And will appear almost in the middle of the Bible, if you look. But won't appear on the screen. Because I've managed to save two things of the same thing. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hand. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge. They have no speech, they use no words, no sound is heard from them. Yet their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. In the heavens God has pitched a tent for the sun. It is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, like a champion rejoicing to run his course. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is deprived of its warmth. The law of the Lord is perfect, refreshing the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The decrees of the Lord are firm, and all of them are righteous. They are more precious than gold, than much pure gold. They are sweeter than honey from the honeycomb. By them your servant is warned. In keeping them there is great reward. But who can discern their own errors? Forgive my hidden faults. Keep your servant also from willful sins. May they not rule over me. Excuse me. Then I will be blameless, innocent of great transgression. May these words of my mouth and this meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight, Lord, my rock and my redeemer. May God bless us that reading from his word. I'm only going to say one thing, and that is, you have all of creation talked about in the first six verses. And then the rest of it is about doing what God wants. And that comes from John chapter 2, verses 13 to 22. So it's John chapter 2, verses 13 to 22. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at the tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple courts, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market." His disciples remembered that it is written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." The Jews then responded to him, "What sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." They replied, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to raise it in 3 days?" But the temple he had spoken of was his body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. And God bless to us that reading from his word. Excuse me. Can anyone tell me a problem with this passage. They haven't understood him, okay. I'm thinking of a much more simple problem. What did I say the reading was? John chapter 2. When does Jesus cleanse the temple? When does Jesus cleanse the temple? After what? After the transfiguration and what else? After the triumphal entry. But this is John chapter 2. It's too early. This has created a bit of a problem for scholars, okay? And I'm not sure that I can answer the problem. But scholars have come up with three options. One is that John's wrong. Okay? And that is that John has got the time wrong. And this is beautiful, this one. I love this. That John hadn't finished his gospel when he died. And it was just a collection of papers, and people just inserted it willy-nilly. Which does kind of, well, yeah, there's quite a high intellectual price tag with that, to be perfectly honest. Everything else seems to be quite consistent, so why is it here? The other option is that there were two cleansings of the temple, one at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, and one at the end of Jesus' ministry. It's possible. I'm not sure that they'd let him back in the temple if he'd smashed it up the first time. And the third option is that John is concerned with truth, not facts. And I'm happier with the third option. And what I mean by that is John is making a theological point here about who Jesus is. And it doesn't really matter to him when it happened, just that it did happen. Jesus is in Jerusalem for a Passover. And if you read John's Gospel, and this is where the difference between John and Matthew, Mark, and Luke comes in. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus spends most of his time hanging around Galilee, doesn't he? And he gradually makes his way for one entry into Jerusalem. If you read John's Gospel, he is in and out of Jerusalem like a yo-yo. He's at different feasts. He goes to at least three Passovers in John's Gospel. And it would make sense. He was a devout Jew, and he would want to go to Jerusalem for Passover. Why wouldn't he? His parents did it with him. If we read Luke's Gospel, his parents took him to Jerusalem for Passover. When he gets to Jerusalem for the final time, he says, "Go and meet this man. There is a room prepared." It's like he's been there before. So it's not that either of them are wrong. It's just John is making a different point. And the point that John is making is that the Messiah would be the one who would be consumed with zeal for the house of the Lord. And when he walks into the house of the Lord and he sees these people using it badly, he will, to use the expression or the vernacular, kick some tail. Okay? He will make sure that these people who are abusing it will be kicked out. Now, here's where we really need to start to understand something. Why does Jesus do it? This is the religious system, okay? You've got to pay your temple tax. You've got to pay for your sacrifices. It's an animal sacrificial system. You've got to buy them from somewhere. They've got to be good enough for God. So what's the problem? Malcolm, if we could have the slide that's next to that one, I'll explain to you the problem. What? As in, there's another one on the screen that says temple tax our temple info, facts and figures. Thank you, Malcolm. I should have explained that beforehand. Right. So I'm going to read it out to you just in case you can't see it. The average wage of a worker was the equivalent of 4p per day. Okay? The temple tax must be paid by every man over the age of 19. And that was one half shekel, which was the equivalent of about 6p. So it's a day and a half's wages just to pay the temple tax. Only Galilean shekels or temple shekels could be used, because everything else was seen to be tainted. Because you couldn't use Roman silver, because that had been offered to other gods and therefore was impure. You could only use good silver, and that is good Galilean silver or temple silver. And they would much prefer it if you used temple silver, because you had to change your money. They would charge you one maha, thank you, for every shekel changed. That charge was a one penny. And one maha for every half shekel issued. Therefore, if you changed two shekels in order to pay your temple tax, you had to pay 1p to get it changed and 3p to receive the change. So that's another day's wages just to get your money changed. That's a man from Birmingham speaking right there. I heard that brilliantly, Richard. That's a rip-off. Okay, just to put this into some sort of context, I'm using figures from quite a while ago. It'd probably be higher now. But £75,000 in British money was the annual revenue from the temple tax. And when you think you're just going in 4p or 6p increments, that's an awful lot of money that's going through in the temple tax. Off which the money changers were making about £9,000 profit per year. When Crassus sacked Jerusalem in 53 BC, he took £2.5 million out of the treasury, and he didn't come close to exhausting it. That gives us some context as to what's going on. It costs you more to pay the temple tax than you earn in a day. Go on to the next slide, please, Malcolm. Gets better. Because when you get there, you want to do your sacrifice, don't you? And it's got to be the right sacrifice. You had to pay a penny just to have your sacrifice inspected. Just going to the temple is looking pretty costly, isn't it? This is all an advert for the gift day. So, 1p just to have your sacrifice inspected. If you bought two doves outside of the temple, it would roughly cost you 4p. Inside the temple, 75p. If it was bought from outside, it was almost certain to be rejected. I wonder why. That's the problem. You didn't go to the temple very often, just to make sure. But this is why. Now, do we get the idea why Jesus might be a little bit miffed? And I think this is really powerful. Because all this is doing is excluding the poor from God. And Jesus is not happy with that. In Psalm 19, we heard about this beautiful thing that is the law. And it's saying, come and search for me. His ways are good. His law is perfect. It's better than gold, much pure gold. It's sweeter than honey, even honey from the honeycomb. This stuff is absolutely amazing. So you might actually want to go and learn at the temple. about this wonderful God. But only if you're of a certain income bracket. If we could go back to the Bible slide, that would really help. Please, thank you, Matt. So, only if you're good enough. So, having all of that in your head, you read the first few verses here. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves. Now, doves are the cheapest thing you can buy. Imagine how much sheep and cattle cost you. And others sitting at tables, exchanging money, and making a pretty hefty profit out of it. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple courts, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market." His disciples remembered that it is written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." Do you get why John's doing this? John is demonstrating that if you want a Messiah, this is what the Messiah does. And it's really important for John that the first thing you see after the baptism, and he's done something with some wine in Cana, is that actually he goes to Jerusalem. He's like, "I've had enough of this. We're setting up a stall." There is no doubt about who Jesus is in John's mind, and he doesn't want you to have any doubt about who Jesus is. He doesn't want his readers to look at him and go, "I wonder who this Jesus might be." No, we're not messing around. This Jesus is the Messiah. He is doing the things that the Messiah should be doing. And he's standing up for the ordinary people. You see, if we don't have that context of how much things cost and how difficult it must have been just to go and give thanks, this just seems like a weird prophetic act. And I know all of you pretty much have sat in a Bible study where I've talked to you about the, you know, they were ripping people off. The reason I want you to see this is they were really ripping people off. This wasn't just making an extra bob or two on the side. This was extortion at an industrial level. And it was being done in the name of religion. So why does Jesus cleanse the temple? One, we've got John's point. He cleanses the temple because it's the sort of thing that the Messiah does. Two, he wants to make it a place where everyone can encounter God. That's the point of the temple. Oh, and by the way, do you know the place where you held the market? The market was held in the court of the Gentiles. There are three courts. The court of the Gentiles, the court of the women, and the court of the men. And then there's the Holy of Holies. So if God is the God of all creation and the God of all nations, what does it say to the traveler who has come to pay homage to the God of all creation when they walk in to the middle of a market? There's no respect for God, and there's no respect for that person. Now, you and I, we're the court of the Gentiles. We can't go any further. How am I going to focus on God in the midst of complete noise and hustle and bustle and bleating and mooing and chirruping? Which I think that's what doves do. How am I going to focus on God in the midst of that? How am I going to experience God in the midst of that? Are we putting barriers in the way of people encountering God? Jesus walks in and he says, yes, this right now is a barrier to people coming to know the Father. It's a barrier financially. It's a barrier because you have no respect for it and it's just noise. Why does the market stall have to be inside the temple? Why can't the market stall be outside the temple? But no, you've got no respect. It's just you're doing what you're doing. This is the depths of organized religion and how bad it can get. Absolutely, Lynn. If you're not Jewish, you don't matter. You can see a righteous anger. It's not just zeal for the house of the Lord. This is a passion and a burning anger of how dare you get in the way of people encountering God. How dare you? And the question that we've got to ask ourselves is, do we do that? Do our attitudes, do the way that we do things, actually get in the way of people encountering God? I'm not saying they do. I don't want you all to walk home or go home thinking that I've had enough of you all and you're all evil and whatever. But are we stopping people because we're doing what we're doing, but aren't actually allowing God to do what he does? So, our vision statement is that we are to be the garment of Christ. Well, to be the garment of Christ is to be available, to be hanging around at the hem of Jesus' garment. That's us. And we're just the physical thing that people can reach out and touch. But are we? Do we run the risk of making the garment Jesus? And what I mean by that is, do we run the risk of making all of this the most important thing and not the personality of Jesus? When I was in Reading, we used to have the Reading Coin Club meet in the downstairs of the hall, excuse me, on the first Monday of every month. They were quite good payers. They came with all sorts of different coins. But one year I was doing Bible study on the Monday of Holy Week, and we were turning over the temple, money changers in the temple. And I said, let's go and reenact it. But no one came with me. Anyway, do we run the risk of making this the most important thing? Because it's not. And I know you all know that. This is not the most important thing. Whether we have red chairs or blue chairs is not the most important thing. Whether they're comfortable or not is not the most important thing. Whether you are singing the latest Matt Redman or you are singing plain song, it's not actually the most important thing. What it is are you creating space so that people can reach out and touch Jesus? Because I'm not the Savior. And neither are any of you. This church is just a building. When people come into this place, it is just a building. Well, we can imbue it with all sorts of stuff. We can say it feels spiritual and it feels different. Yeah, it might do. But actually, it's still just a building. It's still made out of bricks and mortar and some plaster. and some concrete and some windows. It's just that. What's important is about how we might facilitate people meeting with the risen Christ. That's what's important. excuse me. Paul writes, I have become all things to all men, so by all possible means I might save some. Now there's a vision statement for a church. Meet people where they are, and actually try and funnel yourself into a position so that you are available to everyone. Not just the occasional person or even the people you want through the door. You are available. Can we really say that we are hoping to be the center of the community if we're open twice a week? Are we making ourselves available? And I'm not saying that we need to just work our little socks off and be open every day and everyone burn themselves out. I'm really not saying that, but how are we making ourselves available to where God wants us to make ourselves available? Now, don't get me wrong, I think actually as a church we do quite well. I think we make ourselves available in lots of different ways. And ways that actually some of us aren't even aware of. But our actions can't get in the way of people encountering Christ. I've shared this before, I think. And I know that some people will consider this a really trite example. But I want you to hear it with the genuineness with which it's shared, okay? My grandmother, who I never met, because she died in 1974, and I wasn't born until 1978, so we kind of, our diaries didn't match. But when she was in her 20s, her father was dying. And she went to church. And she went to church for some solace and to encounter Christ. She'd heard about Jesus. She'd grown up as a Christian. And she went to church because that was the place you go to hear good news and to hear that things were going to be okay. And what she heard was hellfire and damnation. If you don't know Jesus, you're going to hell. Now, whilst that's true, have your actions got in the way of actually someone coming to know Jesus? She walked out of that church and didn't walk back into one for anything other than a wedding until my father's ordination in 1969. And she died 4 years later, or 5 years later, depending on your maths. she died 4 and a bit years later, at the age of 53. Did one person's actions actually stop someone coming to know Christ? And it was probably really well-intentioned. But how much do we put barriers in the way? We need to be careful about the messages that we deliver. We need to be careful about what comes out of the pulpit. We need to be careful about the welcome. We need to be careful about the way we serve tea and coffee. We need to be even careful about the way we give out biscuits. And I'm not joking. A slightly more light-hearted example, Naomi, when she was in, we moved up to Reading, that girl effected more change in 1 week than I think I managed in 5 years. she walked in and we went to our first service, and everyone kind of said thank you very much and went home. And there was one person tidying up, and Naomi said, and bear in mind she's only three, went, in my old church we had tea and coffee after the service. Sure enough, the next week we had tea and coffee after the service. Now, I'm not saying that Naomi is a major change maker, but the point is, it would have affected Naomi. She saw the thing that was wrong, and she went, but you just do tea and coffee. You haven't given me a drink. I'm thirsty. Sounds scriptural? And it was that sense of let's meet each other. Now, she's only three. So I'm not sure she's gotten particularly deep into it theologically, but the point is, by our actions, we welcome people. This morning, we were blessed to have Derek with us, who was assessing Trudy. We were blessed by Trudy's service, we were blessed by her sermon, but I was particularly blessed by Derek and his wife's reaction. What a lovely church you have. We felt really comfortable. What lovely people. We're sorry we can't stop for tea and coffee. We've got to go to London. It is amazing that you have an evening service. We will try and come along to an evening service, because there are times when we miss the morning service because we're doing stuff with family and we still want to worship God. So the fact you've got an evening service is really good for us. Well, hello, we've just met someone. Now, they're Christians, he's a retired minister, that's fine, but you're meeting people where they are just by being open. Cameo, you are meeting people where they are. Is it huge? No. Does it matter? No. Busy Bees, you're meeting mums and dads and carers and little people. I'm not sure what to call them anymore, whether they're babies, toddlers, or just little people. But you're meeting them at their point of need. You're meeting them where they are, and you're making yourself available so that they might encounter the risen Christ through you. Funfield Fridays. Breakfast Club. We sound quite busy, don't we? All of these different things, you are just making yourself available. Could we do more? Probably. Should we? Don't know. That's up to God to tell us. But we can't stand in the way. My challenge in this passage is, what would Jesus do when, if he were to return to this church? Would we be paying for some new chairs? Because he's thrown them around the room saying, get out, how dare you? And I think that's the greatest challenge all of us need to answer, actually, is if Jesus was to walk in here today, and Jesus encourages us to answer this question throughout the Gospels, actually. If I were to, you know, the bridegroom will come and you won't know when. What will he find you doing? Chatting. What will he find you doing? Will he find you sat there blocking someone else's view? Blocking someone else's access? Will he be having to make a whip just to drive people out? All of you have been to a theatre and had a taller person in front of you. Even I've been to a theatre and had a taller person in front of me. And I try and buy seats with leg room because I'm a taller person. And what is the reaction of you as the person sat behind? Could you just sit? You spend your entire, you find yourself at a really weird angle like that, going, this is a fantastic play, I hope it doesn't last very long. Because you want the person to get out of the way. And that's our challenge from this, is are we prepared to get out the way and let God do what God needs to do? I would not want the judgment of Jesus to be leveled against the church of you got in people's way of knowing me. By your attitudes, by your actions. I try and make sure that we have, anyone who has led worship tries to make sure that you've got a mixture of worship styles and worship songs, because for some people it's going to be really helpful and for other people it might not be. But do you know, that's why we've got the choice of 5 or 6 songs in the service. For some people you'll access something and you'll go, that's fantastic, and other people it'll leave them cold, but that's okay. Because as long as there's something within that service, we've done our job, as it were. We've made ourselves available so that people can encounter Christ. If you go into a cathedral, I took the kids into Ely Cathedral, or Ely Cathedral, depending on how you're saying it, Ely Cathedral. Took my kids into Ely Cathedral a few years ago. And you know what the kids are like. They can be, you know, live wires, I think is the word I'm looking for. But there was a sense where then when they walked into that place, it was, I need to speak quietly. And looking up in awe. Now that's a place that's designed for people to encounter God. Our building isn't that great. You walk in here, people do not feel like being quiet. But there are other ways that we can encourage people to encounter God. One thing that the older... Those of us that are older and have been around church longer miss in some ways is the quiet before the service. It used to be that you would come into church and for about 2-3 minutes beforehand you'd have some gentle music playing possibly, but people would be reading their Bibles or they'd be in prayer, and we don't have that anymore. We have a conversation about this, that, and the other. But wouldn't it be great to bring that back? Because what you're then doing is you're encouraging people to just spend some time with God, to meet with God, by not going over to them and asking them about coffee or whether they've got this thing or that thing sorted. Just giving everyone a couple of minutes before the service to just go, oh, I'm here, I'm preparing myself before the Lord because I want him to speak with me and for me to encounter him. There's a practical thing we could all do. And if you guys all did it, other people would copy, I hope. If a big proportion did it. But it's about us making sure that we create those spaces. One comment that I took very seriously was, it would have been lovely to have had some silence in the service. Do we spend so much of our time trying to fill it up, making sure we've done everything, that the one person who doesn't get to speak is God? Wouldn't it be good if we had silence in prayer meetings? Or in prayer? Sometimes we'll pray and we'll go, God, I've got a few things that I need to get off my chest. This needs sorting, that needs sorting, that needs sorting. Right, well, thank you very much. I'm on my way. Where does God get to speak back? We pray to God and we say, Lord, will you give us the answer to such and such a question? And we do it as a group. And then we move on. Not giving God the opportunity to just even have a one-word answer. Do we stop ourselves from being able to access God? Jesus dies on a cross for everyone, saying, here I am. Come and access me. Come and accept the gift that I'm giving you of forgiveness and mercy, of help. Come and do that. And the call of his church must be to make Jesus accessible.